Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Wealth. I'm Alex Teagan. I'm coming to you from New York City, and I'm joined from far across the country in San Diego, Ian Wenig. Ian, how are you?
I'm doing well. This is going better than my last remote podcast recording when I could barely sit.
Yeah, your back is in place for this one, which is great. We're also joined by Andrew Forsch. Andrew, with a fantastic posture, a great spine, and sitting in sunny Washington, D.C.
That's correct. Yeah, healthy as ever.
Excellent. Well, great to see you all. We've got a producer based in London, so we're straddling multiple time zones. We're about an eight-hour gap here that we've managed to get across to record this. Such is our dedication and sort of contractual obligation. But anyway, fantastic to be here. I think we've got quite a lot to discuss. We're going to kick off by talking about a big mega trend rather than a specific story, and that is sort of how the RIA space is evolving. Quite a lot to fit into, 20 minutes. The trigger for this conversation, I suppose, was some comments made by Michael Nathanson, who is the CEO of Focus Financial Partners. He made these comments at a conference earlier this week, and the thrust of what he said was that we're in a new age for RIAs. He also said that the age of the founder is over, and he said that, it's not enough for aggregators just to buy RIAs anymore. Even that game's changed. And this kind of struck us in the newsroom because it's reminiscent of a conversation that we've had quite a few times that I suppose we would loosely call the RIA 2.0 conversation, the sort of how things have changed and where things are now for that industry. So I guess we'll get into exactly what Michael said and whether we entirely agree with it or not. But perhaps Ian, as someone who I think we've probably had the most thoughts on this, what do you think he means by this new age of RIAs? And perhaps to unpack that, kind of what was the old age of RIAs and how is it different today?
Yes, I mean, this is something that, frankly, we've been writing about and talking about for 5 years. And similar to how Michael described it, I've kind of talked about it as this grand transition from RIAs being personality-defined businesses to institutionally-driven businesses. And so you sent a couple of bullet points about some of these changes, and I think that it can best be summed up.
Don't reveal the actual work that we do before. I assume people think we just do this off the cuff. Anyway, sorry, please.
Well, I'm doing this off the cuff. This is no notes.
Oh, and Ian's done no prep. Okay, that's the key thing you need to know.
Yeah, it's just you alone behind the curtain, really.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I think a lot of this stuff can be summarized by the corporate history of Hightower Advisors, which we have spoken extensively about. And so Hightower's founding story was that it was based on these wirehouse team breakaways moving to independence, and it relied a lot on the charisma and the personality of Elliot Weissbluth, who was the company's founder. And then, again, we talked about this before, I won't belabor the point. They attracted advisors by promising them equity, which would vest when the company went public. The IPO never happened. A lot of advisors became elevator assets and left. And then Thomas H. Lee Partners, private equity firm, came in and basically bought a significant stake in the company. Elliot Weissbluth moved on. The founder went out. PE firm got much more involved, worked with the CEO that they helped source, Bob Oros, to buy the advisors' books of businesses, keep them on the platform. And now we're at a point where Hightower has become a serial RIA investor and acquirer. And the PE firm THL, they have a clearly defined operational role where Gurinder Ahluwalia, who has a significant role at THL, he's now Hightower's president. And THL moved Hightower's investment into a continuation vehicle. So they're still keenly, deeply involved in the business. I mean, that's kind of the example, right? Like Hightower was originally a company with this fancy jet black corporate logo, clear brand identity that Elliot Weissbluth created, manifested. And nowadays, even the logo looks different with oranges and blues. It looks and feels and operates totally differently than its original founding vision.
Okay, so we'll come back to kind of what the optimal colors are for an RAA phase one business and an RAA phase two business, because that stuff is perfect for an audio format. But let's unpack that a little bit, because I think there's a lot in what you said, and I think it's a really great point using Hightower as a case study effectively. So that first iteration, a few things leap out. So first of all, it was wirehouse breakaways. That was the basic initial model, wasn't it? It was teams within wirehouses who had managing a decent chunk of money, thinking, hang on a second, why am I kicking up so much back to Merrill, Wells, whoever? And indeed, they might also be thinking, hey, why am I restricted by what the bank wants to push on me product-wise? They might be thinking, you know, I don't like these certain practices. There may be many, many a reason for it, but ultimately, I want greater independence, potentially a greater share of my own revenue, potentially a better deal and better options for my end clients. I'm going independent. And that's the sort of ultimate genius of it all. And then firms like Hightower existed. And I think the other thing that you also said there with regards to Hightower, which is really interesting, is that the initial model was kind of like the pre-PE model, right? Wasn't it? It was like you all joined, but you got equity in this bigger thing. And the idea was to have an IPO, if anyone remembers what IPOs were, because they don't seem to happen anymore. Was that sort of very phase one, you think? And then the founder thing, I suppose, you mentioned there, Elliot being kind of the founder, but also the other thing was these firms were somewhat founder-led by the team leaders from these wires who went on to found their businesses, and they were obviously still crucially very involved in their RAAs post-breakaway. But let's just dig into this founder point for a second then, because Michael made the point, he was speaking on stage, so he didn't, write a thesis on all these points. But his line was, the age of the founder is over. So is that true at multiple levels? Is that true both at the level of the sort of breakaway team and also at the larger aggregator model too? Or just across the board, really, are we seeing kind of founders make way for different leaders?
I agree. And so the moment that sticks in my head right now is back in December of 2018, when I had basically no idea what I was doing. I went to the Market Council Summit out in Las Vegas, and there was an all-star panel at the time that Brian Hamburger, a top RA attorney, had organized with Elliot Weissbluth, who we mentioned, Ron Carson, the founder of Carson Group, Joe Duran, who at the time was still running United Capital, and we had Cheryl Penny, who was the founder of Dynasty Financial Partners. And I remember all four of them had martini glasses on stage, and they all made a toast. And I think, 7 years later, obviously we're in a different place as a company. I'm in a different place as a journalist. And with the quasi-exception of Cheryl Penny, a lot of those people are in very different places. So Joe Duran, obviously, we talked about United Capital, sold that to Goldman, stayed at Goldman as a partner, left. Now he's running a new RE minority investing business. Ron Carson at Carson Group. He's still the majority owner of that company, but he's not the day-to-day leader. That's Burt White, who the private equity sponsor, Bain Capital, helped bring in. And then Cheryl Penny, Cheryl is still CEO, but that's a company with multiple outside investors, including InvestNet and Avery Partners, a private equity firm, and Charles Schwab. And also Dynasty isn't exactly an aggregator of RA assets. They're a service provider to RAs, and now in this new kind of corporate phase, a minority investor in RAs. And so those are four people in very different positions now.
That's really interesting. And I think you raise another good point there, which is around the role of the aggregator. And you touched on this again with Hightower and also to some degree with Dynasty, which we know is a different model. But I think when maybe let's call it that sort of phase one of the RAA movement, you had a lot of firms set up like a Dynasty, like a Hightower, like multiple others, apologies for not mentioning you, mentions are in no way endorsements, but existed to effectively sort of support the breakaway movement. And obviously they collected some sort of basis point fee for that support. But what seems to have changed or become more prevalent is I guess the realization that actually that wasn't enough, because as you said with Hightower, those whether they were 1099 contractors or whether they were just paying you a service fee in the case of Dynasty, that wasn't a great business model for you. And instead now what you're seeing is more and more people, and I think we saw it this week even with Mariner, But more and more people moving to the W2 model, because again, it centralizes everything. It puts everything in one platform. It's a stickier business. It's ultimately a better business if you're trying to then do something with that. Is that another kind of part of this new age?
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. And maybe, Andrew, we can kind of get you involved here because you've covered these stories fairly closely too.
Yeah, I think I think another aspect is, yes, I think firms want initially to set up as many different touch points for advisors as possible. These large PE-backed firms, they don't want to just buy independent RIAs. I mean, they do want to do that, but they also want to recruit teams out of wirehouses still. So at first, they want to offer as many affiliation models as possible, and then over time, they want to give optionality or, you know, in some cases, maybe kind of nudge these advisors to selling into things like W2. I mean, our whole kind of trigger for this conversation was Michael Nathanson's talk, "Look at what Focus has done under CD&R's ownership." It's the prime example. You know, they're consolidating all of these platform affiliates. And everybody, as long as I've been covering the business, has mentioned, you know, there's great value to be unlocked at Focus by integrating these firms. And, you know, we had Focus founder Rudy Adolph on stage a couple of weeks ago in Nashville at one of our due diligence conferences. And, you know, he spoke about, like, yes, there was value to be created there, but that they were, his vision was something different at the time. Of course, CD&R buys in. Now he's not there anymore. They've got Michael Nathanson in that top role, and they're going about that plan.
Yeah, I think that's a really good sort of point to bring us back to Michael's comments, which are, not only has the game changed, you know, in totality, but also specifically for aggregators, this idea that, okay, and at this point, maybe he's talking his own book a bit, I think, you know, like, I think, you know, we have to take anything that's said on a conference stage with a little bit of a pinch of salt. But with that said, I think it's interesting. And I think what you've said supports this, which is that, yeah, it's not enough now just to buy up firms, you know, and not that anyone was necessarily being this passive about it, but just buy them up, sit there, watch the market do its work, and then, you know, hope to sell it on down the line for X amount more than you previously paid for it. Again, I think from the same conference, we had a conversation, Alec Rich, who is in Miami, but sadly, listener, we couldn't get a fourth location on this. But speaking to Joe Durand out of Miami and him explaining to us how he made his sort of aggregation model work. Maybe aggregation is the wrong word. One second.
We've got a special guest on the podcast today.
We've got a child. This is very COVID. This is very 2021. We've got a child interrupting the podcast. We're going to scratch this. It's going to get too messy. We're going to cut this.
I don't know. I think we keep it in it initially. It's fun. That's kind of fun.
There we go. We did get a fourth guest after all, but not from Miami. Okay, where were we? The model changed for
seeing my future unfold in front of me here.
Yeah, well, if you're lucky enough to podcast, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the real dream. Where were we? The aggregator model has changed. The aggregator model, it's not enough to buy. You've got to do more. Duran was talking about this. Like, I don't know whether that means getting more out of the companies that you buy, whether that means what Nathanson was talking about in terms of, you know, smashing them all together, but consolidating entirely.
Well, I'll chime in on that. I think, like, also a part of it is, I mean, all of that is true. You want to extract as much value as these owners want to extract as much value as possible out of the investments that they make. But also, like, I think there's a focus. I don't want to play it up too much, but there's a focus on, like, I don't know, there are questions of, is M&A good for the end client, right? And so I think lately there's been a focus not just on aggregating assets, but on expanding services. So being, like, more intentional about, you know, real specialists in one thing or another, kind of tertiary or auxiliary services, tax planning, estate planning, that kind of thing, trust services, things like that. And not just aggregating assets, but, like, creating more service lines that ultimately do benefit end clients. Of course, like, when acquirers talk like that, treat that with a reasonable amount of skepticism, but there is some amount of truth to it, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think maybe journalists are naturally a little, I don't know if you're more any more skeptical than the general public, but perhaps more hardwired to be. Yeah, when I see that stuff, in my mind, I'm like, well, that's just another thing you could sell, isn't it? That's just about extracting more value from the asset rather than, you know, is it better for the end client? But maybe I'm being unfair. But this brings us back to, I guess, maybe the end point of this conversation, which is also about something Jonah Rand said or defended in comments this week, which is, you know, with these large RIAs, when they are increasingly centralized, whether that's by investment proposition, whether that's by sort of shared services, etc., when everything becomes a bit more homogenous, at what point are they then meaningfully different from wirehouses? So he wrote a column for us, I want to say a month or so ago, in which he basically said they aren't. He took a lot of flack for that. Why, I don't know. What do we think? Do we think he had a point? Ian, you were involved certainly in getting a lot of emails on the pushback on this point. Thoughts?
Yeah, we're getting additional feedback now on the interview we just did with Joe. And I think, you know, I think that there is some truth to what he's saying. I mean, we actually wrote a story right before COVID in 2020, asking, are RIAs getting more like wires? And I think that you can see this when you think about how scaled up they are. I think that the best example of this is the lawsuits that we see over fights for advisor talent. And that now, instead of, it used to be a almost unidirectional flow of wirehouse assets out to RIAs. But now you see RIAs trying to pick each other off for talent. I mean, to make a connection back to like Joe Durant's career, I mean, look, there was a massive flood for talent when the advisors from United Capital that then joined Goldman and became Goldman PFM, and that got sold to Creative Planning. A lot of those scattered to the wind, and Goldman pursued arbitration against a lot of them. Like, that's what happens now. These firms, you know, a lot of the valuations ultimately based on keeping advisors in the building, keeping client books of business in the building. And yeah, they're not playing nice with each other anymore. They're fiercely in competition with one another. And I think that that's something that's sharpened now relative to 2018, 2019.
And what about culturally? I mean, you know, if we go back to that first age of the RIA, where, you know, one argument was these teams are leaving the wires so they can offer their clients a better deal, so they have, I don't know, better investment options, fewer guardrails around what they're allowed to do. You know, the argument, you know, perhaps lower fees they can offer because they're not being forced to cross sell certain products and that kind of thing. This is harder for us to answer because none of us work inside an RIA firm that's been acquired by an aggregator, which has then been acquired by a PE firm. But what's your sense on that? Are they culturally very different now to what they were when they first broke away? Do they mimic the wires more?
So I'll make a nice flashy pass to Andrew, because I think that, you know, I think about some of the Mercer, ACG Wealth stuff, where you see some of these firms sell, and then, yeah, they just don't fit. And it's very difficult. I mean, there are some exceptions, but I think it's really difficult to have a uniform culture when you have offices spread across the country, different geographies, different advisors from different cultural backgrounds. It's very tough to have like the similar kind of top-down standardized experience, both for the advisor and the end client, once you get to a certain point of scale.
And these are entrepreneurial teams. These are people who literally did set out, you know, to hang out on their own shingle, if I've got that phrase right. I now wonder if I have. So does that perhaps make them a harder group to?
And I think that inherent entrepreneurial spirit, I think, will act as a brake on the growth of these big firms, because a lot of people left the wires because they didn't want to work for a mega firm.
Okay, so then this I think brings us. This question could bring us to a nice sort of end point here, which is, if we very broadly say there was a phase one and that we're in a sort of phase or age two, maybe an era even, who knows, what's phase three look like? What's, you know, if we're having this conversation in 3 years' time, let's say 4 years' time, when Andrew's children are interrupting the podcast, what do we think things look like there?
I'll make a point that as long as I've been covering the business, I've been hearing about this idea of a merger of mega RIAs. We haven't seen it yet. Who knows? I'm speculating. Maybe that happens. We see the $1 trillion. What CapTrust is already $1 trillion. I mean, Creative Planning's growing at a ridiculous rate year over year. So it's a long way. I don't know, but I think we'll get there.
No, but that's a really good point, isn't it? It's some of it's a size thing, and some of it is, yeah, we've heard a lot about this, whether substantiated rumors or just speculation, either of which we're fans of, by the way. The merger of aggregators, that could be a kind of a nice kind of bell for a different era. Ian?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the other thing we have to mention, and this is kind of, I'll go full circle here. We talked about the IPO market, and I think in the next 5 years, I don't know if we'll see someone succeed, but I think we'll see a big firm try to go public again. And if that works, we could see a parade of firms following. And I don't even know what the second order effects of that would be.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, look, that's really interesting. I think, sort of either way, some kind of, what's the right phrase? Liquidity event for those massive firms would sort of mark a kind of a new staging post, at least. Well, guys, look, I think we've covered a lot there. I realize there's probably a kind of thesis in there somewhere that we've burnt by just chatting about it for 20 minutes. But thank you both for your thoughts. Before we go, Ian, what exactly, other than, keeping your back in shape, are you doing in San Diego? And actually, yeah. I should say also, other than just going to see your beloved Padres, because you are there for work. You're not just there for baseball.
Yes, but I was able to bring a professional colleague to the game yesterday, so I was able to blend both. But the main reason that
they were playing the Dodgers this week. How many of those games did you get to see?
Two.
Two. How did the Padres do?
Lost 2 out of 3. But I went to the one victory, and I went to the game. Yes, that was a loss on Wednesday. We're taping Thursday.
You saw the 11-1 victory.
Yes, I did see the 11-1 victory. That was quite emotionally satisfying to see.
Brilliant. Okay, right. On to the serious stuff. Beyond the baseball, what are you doing there?
The main reason that I am here is that I am chairing our inaugural CIO summit in San Diego. Well, to be specific, though, we are in La Jolla, which is just north of downtown.
Okay. And I realize we've caught you kind of in the morning on the first day, so you can't give us a full rundown of how it's all gone. But thoughts so far, vibe being good, anything interesting you're hearing from advisors that you can share and don't want to squirrel away for a future story?
Yeah, vibe has been good. You'll see, by the time that this pod comes out, you'll see a story from our colleague Sam Bujarski, frequent podcast guest, and he will be writing up the panel talk that I had between myself and Kurt Mashinsky. More of a fireside chat than a panel, just correcting myself live. And we talked
and
a little
Kurt
bit
is,
about...
For readers less familiar with his name?
Kurt is the chief executive of Cerity Partners, which is a large RIA, about $123 billion in assets that has grown through both organic growth, acquisitions. And honestly, we talked about a lot of these things that... we just discussed on the podcast about its growth into a mega firm. But I think one thing that is interesting, and I hope that Sam focuses on this, we'll find out tomorrow, is that Kurt talked about how he has never taken his own personal chips off the table. He's never taken a cent off the table in terms of his initial equity investment in the business, which he founded with assistance from billionaire Howard Milstein back in the day. Howard's no longer involved. But I thought that was fascinating. I asked him, what does it say about the company culture that you're still all in. You haven't taken chips off the table. And we also talked a little about his maturation as a leader as the firm has grown. And he admitted that, he was maybe overly reliant on just sticking to the facts. I mean, it almost reminded me of Mr. Gradgrind from Hard Times, the great Dickens novel. And that eventually...
Say great. That novel is a struggle to get. I mean, it's appropriately named. It is a slog, that book. But anyway.
Yeah, that was part of my AP Lit summer reading heading into senior year of high school. But yeah, I just thought that he was very open about his own need to develop his own EQ, his emotional intelligence quotient, and had to learn when employees were really concerned about things and not to just run them over with facts. And so it just struck me how self-aware he was about what he was like back then versus now and what he needed to do to become a more effective leader at a larger organization.
Excellent. And just to round us out, what else is, obviously by the time this comes out, this would have happened, but what else have we got going on? We've got a panel of CIOs and another speaker. Can you tease those for us?
Yes, we have an all-star panel of four of the top female CIOs in the industry, which will be moderated by Karina Diamond. And then tomorrow, we have Rufus Peabody, who is a professional sports bettor, coming to talk. And I'll do a cross-promotion for another podcast. I gave all the attendees some homework and told them to listen to Rufus's appearance on Planet Money ahead of the talk.
Fantastic. Sports betting at a RIA conference. Ian, it's almost as if you had a hand choosing the speakers.
Well, I don't even fantastic.
No, but you love sports and stats.
That's true.
In an entirely positive way. Excellent. Well, look, we've covered an awful lot of ground. It sounds like a great event, Ian, so I hope the rest of it goes really well for you, and we'll look out for all that coverage as it goes live on the Citywire RAA website. So, Ian, thanks very much for joining us. Andrew, an absolute pleasure. Thank you for joining us from DC. And listener, as ever, thank you for joining us, and we'll be back again soon for another episode of This Week in Wealth.